fitting, Tom, that you did that song today. And actually, Tom told me he was going to do that song this week, but I didn't tell him to do it this week, even though it was just the Lord's will, obviously, that it happened based on when you see what the topic of today's sermon is. Habakkuk chapter 3 is about the joy in the Lord. You know, when we read the Bible, and you've been a Christian for a while, you've probably heard passages that have been taught to you that have told you to have joy at all times, or to rejoice at all times. Have y'all heard those passages before, right? A passage, I'll give you an example of one of them is Philippians chapter 4. It says, "Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. Let your gentle spirit be known to all men. The Lord is near." Have you ever read passages like that and gone, how? You know, you look at Philippians 4 and you go, Paul clearly doesn't know what I'm going through, because he makes it sound so easy, and rejoicing at all times is not that easy. Paul, how am I supposed to have joy at all times? You can say, well, I'm here and I'm fearful of the future and the things that are coming, and I'm not sure what the future holds for me. Or you could be here and say, hey, I feel like I've just got this weight. I've got this pressure on me, and I don't know if I have strength to continue. And that's where Habakkuk chapter 3 can help us. Habakkuk in chapter 3, he does some things, and in doing these things, he finds strength and joy. And my hope really is that as we see what Habakkuk's story, when we look at what Habakkuk did and what his story of his life is, that maybe we can pick up some clues, too, on how we can be helped, too, for the strength and joy in our own lives. So Habakkuk, like I said, we're in the last, this is the last sermon in this series that I've titled it the Questioning Prophet, because Habakkuk was a prophet that questioned God. He was a faithful follower of God, a faithful believer in God. But at the same time, he had some serious doubts. And he has some serious questions, and it stemmed from the fact that even though he believed what the Bible said, and even though he trusted what the Bible said was true, what the Bible said about God and what he was seeing in his life were not matching up. He thought he was seeing some discrepancies between how the Bible describes God and how he felt like God was acting. And so he was a faithful prophet of God that also doubted and questioned God. He lived during the time, about 600 B.C., during the reign of Jehoiakim, who was an evil king in Judah. And during his time, there were these wicked Israelites that were persecuting and harming and stealing and doing all kinds of things against the righteous Israelites that were there, people like Habakkuk. And it seemed like they were going to keep doing that forever and that nobody was going to stop them. And so Habakkuk in chapter 1, he turns to God and he asks two questions. He says, how long, God? How long are you going to let us suffer like this? And why are you allowing this to continue on without doing anything? And God answers him and says, hey, I am listening to you. I have been hearing your prayers. In fact, I am doing something right now. You just can't see it yet. And he tells Habakkuk, he says, I'm bringing the Chaldeans, or otherwise known as the Babylonians, and they're going to come and conquer Judah, and they're going to restore justice to the land. Well, that doesn't help Habakkuk that much, because that's not at all what Habakkuk wanted. That was not the plan Habakkuk wanted to hear from God for his life. Because the Babylonians were even more wicked than the Israelites were at that time. And so then he turns to God in the rest of chapter 2, in the rest of chapter 1, beginning chapter 2, and he basically says, how can this be your plan? This is not at all what I was hoping for in my life. What's going on? What should I do? And God answers him in chapter 2, verse 4, and says, what you need to do is you need to live by faith. The righteous live every single day trusting and having faith in God. And then God continues on, verses 5 through 20 of chapter 2, and he lays out these five plans that we tend to do when we're suffering, but they end up being faulty plans. Even though for the short time they seem to work, in the long run they just hurt us. In order to show that the only true plan that really helps us in our suffering is to live every day with our faith in God. And it's after this response from God to Habakkuk that Habakkuk then in chapter 3 delivers his response. And let's see what his response says. And we'll start off just with the first three verses or so. It says, a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet according to Shigionoth. Lord, I've heard the report about you and I fear. O Lord, revive your work in the midst of years. In the midst of years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. God comes from Timon and the Holy One from Mount Paran. In chapter 3, specifically through verses 1 through 15, Habakkuk is going to picture God in three different ways. And as he pictures God in these three different ways, you'll see in a second that these renewed visions of God helps him and strengthens him and encourages him. And the first thing that Habakkuk turns to is he begins to picture God's renewing mercy. And that's something you can do too. You can picture God's renewing mercy. Verse 1 says that this is a prayer, so Habakkuk prays to God during this time, but it's not just any prayer. It's also a song, because there's musical notations in here like Shigionoth and Selah down there in verse 19. So he sings this prayer to God. A Shigionoth is a rare term. It's only really found in the Psalms, and we think it means an ecstatic, a happy, and a almost like jumping up and down, because it's related to a word meaning to reel or stagger about. So you would read this and it sounds almost like a dirge, but it's actually supposed to be something that's an exciting passage musically with the music notation. But then in verse 2, he begins to share his plea and his request to God. And his request to God is that God renews his mercy. You see, Habakkuk, he's going to remember and he's going to think back to the times when God had been merciful to them in the past. He says, in the work, in the midst of the years, in the midst of the past times, he says, and we'll see in a second, he'll think back to the Red Sea when God saved them from Egypt. He'll think back to the Jordan when they crossed the Jordan. He'll think back to Jericho when he tore down the walls of Jericho. He'll think back to David when he slaughtered Goliath. He'll think back to all these times where God showed his renewing mercy to him. And his prayer and his plea to God is saying, hey, God, if you had that renewing mercy in the past, I know you can have that renewing mercy for us now. I love what he says about God's mercy here, because he's not just praying that God shows them grace, that God shows them compassion, but that God shows them a grace and compassion that revives them. He's praying for a revival. He knows that even though the Israelites and the nation of Israel have sinned greatly, and even though Israel face a real judgment because they have done a real sin, that they have a real God who has a real renewing mercy, and that as much as their sin has increased, God's grace will increase all the more. And so he pictures a God who has a mercy toward them that revives them, that renews them, not just forgives them. And he looks back to the time when God's saving place began with them. Timon, Mount Paran, or where God created the covenant with them, that was God's place where you could say he entered a relationship with Israel. What's neat about Habakkuk is that Habakkuk, he begins to picture God's renewing mercy by looking back at the Exodus experience where God took the Israelites and he saved them from slavery in Egypt and he brought them across the Red Sea and he entered a covenant at Mount Sinai. And we look back at that and we don't really see much of God's renewing mercy, but he looks back and that's enough to give him some strength, that's enough to give him some hope. We have such a greater picture than that in the cross of Jesus Christ. Our saving event is not some man holding a staff, releasing plagues on a nation. Our saving event was a man nailed to the cross, taking the wrath of sin from the world upon his shoulders to free us in eternal life. And we can remember God's renewing mercy in our lives. Sometimes when it seems like our days are dark, You know, we can feel like that we are dying, that we feel like we are weakening, that we are getting, as he was saying a second, like our bones are just crumbling underneath us. As in those times that you can do exactly like Habakkuk did, picture God's renewing mercy. In fact, I want to encourage you to do that right now. Picture God's renewing mercy to you. Remember those times that God has shown mercy to you. Remember those times that God has renewed you. Do it right now. The word Selah there is a musical term that we don't know exactly what it means. It either means that the music should get louder or that the line should be repeated. But whatever it means whatever was just said was important. And yet, you're supposed to think about it. So think about it. Think about the times that your finances have been low and that God somehow managed to renew your finances and keep you afloat even when it seemed like it wasn't possible. Remember those times when your spirits were downcast and you didn't seem like you were going to make it, and yet God somehow got you through that and lifted you up out of the pit of despair. Remember those times when you were steeped into a lifestyle of sin, and yet God still embraced you and forgave you and brought you back out and brought you back to life. Remember the fact that God didn't send mercy to you. And remember the times in your life that God renewed you. Remember that Jesus Christ, the moment, the demonstration that he died on the cross to demonstrate that renewed mercy to you. That's what Habakkuk did. You can do that too. So first, picture God's renewing mercy. And then second, picture God's glorious majesty. Second half of verse 3 goes on to say, his splendor covers the heavens and the earth is full of his praise. His radiance is like the sunlight. He has rays flashing from his hands and there is the hiding of his power. Before him goes pestilence and a plague comes after him. He stood and surveyed the earth. He looked and startled the nations. Yes, the perpetual mountains were shattered. The ancient hills collapsed. His ways are everlasting. I saw the tents of Kishon under distress and the tent curtains of the land of Midian were trembling. Starting in the end of chapter 3 all the way through, end of verse 3 all the way through the end of verse 5, Habakkuk is going to start to picture God a little differently than we tend to, because he's going to start to picture God as a warrior king. So he's not picturing God as some weak grandfather sitting upstairs or Santa Claus that's trying to give them presents or just wants them to be happy or some, loving hippie that's just like, hey, whatever you want to do, that's cool, man. He begins to picture God instead as a warrior king. And the first thing he does when he begins to picture God as a warrior king is he begins to picture the glorious majesty of God. And in verses 3 through verses 4, this glorious majesty is depicted first by how splendid God is. Picture this with me. He says, God comes from Timon and the Holy One from Mount Paran. His splendor covers the heavens, and the whole earth is full of his praise. He says, when I think about God's glory covers the whole earth. There's not an aspect of the earth that can't see God's glory. That's exactly what Paul tells us in Romans chapter 1, where he says, because what's known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes, that is, his eternal power and his divine nature, have always been clearly seen, being understood because of what he has made. So they are without excuse. God is so big that his glory covers the whole earth. He says also that God is radiant, that he shines. Verse 4, that he's bright like the sun when he comes. He says when he reaches out his hands, there's rays flashing from his hands, even though he's trying to conceal it. It says even though God tries to conceal the brightness, even though he's trying to conceal his glory, his splendidness, like it says, these rays, they still break through and they're still blinding as he approaches people. And in fact, the rays there was also the word for horn. So it's the idea of not just being bright, but being a powerful, like the horns on a crown. He's saying that God is splendid when he comes. And then he says God is intimidating when he comes. As if verse 3 and 4 is not intimidating enough. Then in verse 5, he says that his two attendants are pestilence and a plague. Kings back then, when they would come to places, they would have attendants that would come and wait on them. And Habakkuk says, when I picture God's glorious majesty, his attendants aren't people. They're plagues. They're pestilence. Those are actually Babylonian gods. So in a way, he's saying, look, the Babylonian gods, not only are they not gods, But their attendance to God as he marches where he's going. He says, when God stands up, when he looks at the nations and the earth, it startles them. And even mountains shake. Even hills collapse. When you look out at the hills out here, can you imagine the amount of dynamite that it would take to destroy these hills that are around here? The amount of explosions that would have to take to make these things fall down to dust. He says, when God looks at mountains, they turn to dust. Because even things like a hill or a mountain that we think would last forever, he says, only God is eternal in verse 6. And he says, verse 7, that he's coming from Kishon and Midian. These were areas where God created that covenant with Mount Sinai. That's where Mount Sinai is located. But he says God is coming from the place where he created a covenant with his people. For them, that was Mount Sinai. From us, God is coming from the cross. He says, man, God is gloriously majestic, and he's picturing it for us, and he invites you to picture it with him, because this is a song directed by the choir director for everybody to do. Picture God's glorious majesty, how splendid he is, and how intimidating he is. Ash and I got the chance a couple years ago, I know I've said this before, but we managed to go to England on a trip, one of our last trips we got to take before we had kids, and we were able to go to St. Paul's Cathedral in London. And St. Paul's Cathedral is one of the hallmarks of being in London. It's a massive cathedral, and when we walked in, they told us, hey, the upper floors are open today. And we said, sweet, awesome. Let's go check up the upper floors. What they didn't tell us was that there's no elevator to the upper floors. It's only accessed by a circular staircase going up. And the second thing they didn't tell us is that the St. Paul's Cathedral is 364 feet high. That's taller than Big Ben, and it's taller than the Tower Bridge. And so we begin going up this circular staircase, and we should have known we were in trouble, where every few flights, there were benches there for people to rest. We should have known we were in more trouble when the people coming down were red-faced and sweating. We got to the top of this staircase, dizzy because of how many times we got up there, and we stepped out on top of the staircase, and do y'all know what we saw? There was another staircase. This one, the middle. So finally, after going up the middle staircase, we get to the top, we look out, and I turn to Ashton and go, hey, this is beautiful. I'm so glad we came up here. Let's never do this again. It's probably a good thing we did it on our first day. But in St. Paul's, the way they got it designed is you come in the back, like where those doors are, and you walk toward the stage, the front of the church. And as you walk toward the front of the church, the decorations of the building become more and more glorious. They get more and more gold, more and more silver, more and more jewels as you approach the stage. So finally, by the time you get to the front of the church, there is gold everywhere. And the sun's coming through the windows, so it's bright, it's shining. I mean, you've never seen so much gold in your life if you've never been into a cathedral like that before. And you get to the very stage, and right above you is a picture of Jesus sitting on the throne. And he's got golden rays coming off his side. He's got golden rays coming off his head. And the look he has, and he's looking down like this at you. The look he has looking down at you is the look my dad would give me when he's suspicious that I'm doing something I'm not supposed to do. So you're standing there, and there's just gold cherubims everywhere. Decorative jewels everywhere, and Jesus sitting there, and the picture of Jesus inside St. Paul's is not one of an innocent little baby in Mary's arms, not one of somebody weak hanging on the cross. It is a warrior king. And let me tell you what, it is splendid, and it is intimidating to see Jesus looking down at you like that in St. Paul's Cathedral. It changes the way you view that picture. Habakkuk is saying, hey, in his life, in his story, he begins to picture God's, not just his renewing mercy, but his glorious majesty. Do that right now, too. Imagine God breaking out of the clouds and coming and He's so bright you can't hardly see, like when you step out on a hot summer day and you can't see because you don't have sunglasses on. It's like that when God steps out, you can't hardly see him, but when your eyes get adjusted, you begin to notice, and he's reaching out his hand towards you in love, and he's trying to veil that light to you, but you can still see flashes of light coming out of his hand. And the hills around here are shaking and chattering, and rocks are coming because he's coming right for you. Can you picture that in your mind, the glorious majesty of God? You know, I think sometimes we as Christians, we would be helped if we pictured God more like that more often. So Habakkuk pictures God's renewing mercy, and then he pictures God's glorious majesty, and then finally he pictures God's saving might. It says in verses 8 through 15, did the Lord rage against the rivers, or was your anger against the rivers, or your wrath against the sea, that you rode on your horses, on your chariots of salvation? Your bow was made bare, the rods of chastisement were sworn, Selah. You cleaved the earth with rivers, the mountains saw you and quaked, the downpour of water swept by, the deep uttered forth its voice, lifted high its hands. Sun and moon stood in their places, they went away at the light of your arrows. At the radiance of your gleaming spear. In indignation you marched through the earth, in anger you trampled the nations. You went forth for the salvation of your people, for that salvation of your anointed. You struck the head of the house of the evil to lay him open from thigh to neck, Selah. You pierced with his own spear the head of his throngs. They stormed into scatterers, their exultation like those who devoured the oppressed in secret, but you trampled on the sea with your horses on the surge of many waters. Habakkuk continues the theme of seeing God as being a warrior king, but this time he primarily focuses on that Red Sea story. You know, when the Israelites get to the Red Sea and the Egyptians are chasing them on chariots, and God splits the Red Sea to make dry land so that Israel can go through the Red Sea, saving them from Egypt and destroying the Egyptians in the process. He begins that event for the Israelites was, like I said, almost like our cross story. That was their saving event they would think about. He begins to think about that in other times where God showed his saving might. In the first several verses, he thinks about the times God showed his saving might by changing the laws of nature. Verse 8, he asks these questions. Was God's anger against the rivers or against the sea when he split the Red Sea? And the answer is no. God was not angry at water when he did it. He was doing it to save people. But when those walls of water were split and the dry land was made, God was doing that to save people by breaking the laws of nature for it. He says, with Selah, God's bow was made bare and his rod of chastisement was sworn. He said, God cleaved the rivers with those things. Thinking of the Jordan River there, he says, the mountains shook. There's a downpour of water as the deep uttered forth its voice. Were all pictures of Noah and the flood, all pictures of Jericho, all pictures of the Jordan experience. The sun and moon being still reminds us of Joshua when he was in a battle and God stopped the sun and moon from moving so that they could finish the battle and win. All of these are pictures of him saying, hey, God mightily saved Israel by changing the laws of nature. You want to know how strong God's saving might is? He can break the laws of nature to save people. And then he shows that God's saving might is so strong that he even defeats enemies for his people. It says he was coming to save Israel, that he, as it was saying, let's see what it was saying. In verse 12, 13, it says he struck the head of the house of evil, laying him open from thigh to neck. The idea of laying them open from thigh to neck is that all of his armor's gone, all of his defenses are gone, that he's completely vulnerable, and not just completely vulnerable, but because he's naked, he's humiliated, he's disgraced, he's ashamed. He said that's how completely God destroyed these enemies for Israel. And he said not only did God destroy the enemies completely and humiliated them, he says in verse 14, God even used the enemy's own weapon to do it. You know, for the Egyptians, that would have been their fervency to go through the Red Sea to chase the Israelites, and they should have stayed on the land. God used the enemy's own weapons against them to make it happen. And he turned what people thought was going to be a victory for the evil side into a victory for God's side. That's Habakkuk's hope for the people of Babylon, by the way, that God is trying to teach you too. All this showing God's saving might against enemies. What's amazing for Habakkuk is he's completely held. This story of the Red Sea is reviving him. And we've got such a greater story we can look to of God's saving might, don't we? I mean, what greater demonstration is there of God's saving might against enemies than the cross, where Jesus defeated the greatest enemy we could ever have, which is sin and Satan? And what greater demonstration of God's saving might by changing the natural law is the resurrection of Jesus? Because Jesus wasn't resuscitated. Jesus wasn't unconscious and came back to life. Jesus was dead. For 3 days he was dead. God changed the laws of nature to save you from death. And the cross and the empty tomb are not just demonstrations of God's saving might and that he defeated them. Jesus humiliated them. Just like it says, he opened them up from thigh to neck because Jesus took Satan's greatest weapon, which is death. Death is Satan's greatest weapon because nobody can defeat death. Nobody can defeat death. That's why it's Satan's greatest weapon. And Satan took that weapon, death, and he hoped to use that weapon of death against Christ to destroy Christ. So Christ took that weapon of death and turned it around, and he used death to defeat Satan by saving us on the cross. Jesus pierced Satan through with his best spear he could throw at him, and he humiliated him. Not only that, Jesus isn't even done. Because when we say Jesus a lot of times, and I use the word Jesus, I mean, what do you picture? Sometimes I might picture a little baby sitting in Mary's arms, all happy, which I have to think Jesus must have cried as a baby. The idea of him continually being happy, that's not realistic if he was a real human baby. Or you might picture him as a lot of people in our culture might do, long-haired, white robe, cool with everything, good with everything, just gentle. You might picture him as, like I said, this weak guy, almost unconscious on the cross. And none of these pictures are terrible, but they're not complete about who Jesus is. Because we can't forget what it also describes about Jesus in Revelation chapter 19. And I want you, if you have to close your eyes, do it, but picture Jesus this way now. It says, "And I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse, and him who sat on it was called Faithful and True. And in his righteousness he judges and wages war. His eyes are a flame of fire, and on his head are many diadems. He has a name written on him which no one knows except himself. He is clothed with a robe dipped in blood." It's not his blood, it's other people's blood. "And his name is called the Word of God. And the armies which are in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, their robes are white and clean, were following him on a white horse. And from Jesus' mouth comes a sharp sword that he may strike down the nations. And he'll rule them with a rod of iron. And he treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of God Almighty. And on his robe and on his thigh he has named written King of Kings and Lord of Lords." Jesus is also a warrior king. Guess what? By faith in Jesus, he can be your warrior king. You can be part of the people whose clothes are white and clean because Jesus is going in front of you, fighting for you. Picture God in his saving might. Well, let's close out verses 16 through 19 because this is what Habakkuk did. He pictured God's renewing mercy. He pictured God's glorious majesty. He pictures God's saving might. Now see how it helped Habakkuk in verses 16 through 19. It says, "I heard and my inward parts trembled. At the sound, my lips quivered, decay entered my bones, and in my place I trembled. Because I must wait quietly for the day of distress, for the people to arise who will invade us. Though the fig tree should not blossom, and there be no fruit on the vines. Though the yield of the olive should fail, and the fields produce no food. Though the flock should be cut off from the fold, and there be no cattle in the stalls. Yet I will exult in the Lord, and I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. Because the Lord is my strength, and he will make my feet like hinds' feet, and make me walk on my high places, which is for the choir director on my string instruments." Habakkuk says in these last passages that he found joy because he pictured the God who is gloriously strong and came to save him. He admits in verse 16 that he's still scared, I mean, actually, it's a pretty strong description. I'm scared. Everything is trembling. Every piece of his body is shaking because he knows about what's to come. But even though he's scared, he also knows he's going to wait. And he's going to commit that even though he's going to wait and trust God's plan. He knows that he's not going to see God move now. And he knows it might even take years. And he knows he's scared, but he knows he's got to wait. And he's going to trust God. He's doing what God told him to in verse 4 of chapter 2. He's living by faith. And then he makes one of the strongest statements of faith in all the Bible. Verse 17 is a depiction of basically having nothing. That everything is gone. That everything that could possibly bring you any sort of sustenance in life fading away. And yet he says, even though all these things are gone, even though the vine, the fig tree is not blossoming, he said he can still exalt and find joy because he's exalting and rejoicing in the Lord. How can he do that? Because Habakkuk realized that his joy and his strength is not found in the stuff that's in verse 17. His joy and his strength is found in the God described in verses 3 through 15. And he says, when I realize how glorious my God is, how merciful my God is, and how mighty my God is, even if I'm right today, have no blossoms on my fig tree, I can be strong and rejoice in the Lord. And not just have strength, but he says have stability too. The hind deer was a deer that could walk on really tall mountains in the woods and have these just precarious ledges that they would stand on. So he's saying not only am I going to have strength as I wait, but I can have stability as I wait. Because my strength and stability comes from the God of 3 through 15, and not from the stuff in 17. So what does that mean for us? Well, the same thing can be true for you today. You can rejoice in the gloriously strong God who has saved you. In fact, that's the main point. You can rejoice in the gloriously strong God who has saved you. That means first, develop a grand view of God. Habakkuk's story has shown us that how big our view of God is affects how we react to suffering in our lives. And we can sit and go, well, I know everything about God. I have this view of God. But God is infinite, which means that he is bigger than we can ever imagine. There's never a place where you can say, I can't get a bigger view of God or can't learn more about God. And the more and the bigger your view of God is, the more you can rejoice like Habakkuk in that suffering. We need to be people as Christians who develop a grand view of God. It also means that we need to be people who choose to rejoice. Habakkuk's not saying, I'm going to tough it out. I'm going to put on a straight face for the people around me. That's not what Habakkuk's doing at all. He's not vowing to be tough while he waits. He's choosing to rejoice. That's the difference between joy and happiness. Happiness is a feeling you feel based on your circumstances. But joy is not necessarily a feeling. It's the choice. Joy is the choice to rejoice in Christ, no matter what you're going through. And he says, I can rejoice in the God of my salvation. I can find strength in the God of my salvation. I can find joy in the God of my salvation because I make it my choice that even when I have all this stuff gone in my circumstances, which he will, he knows he will because God has shown him, that his God is bigger than all of that. You can do that too. So it kind of takes us back to the very beginning where we say, well, if the Bible tells us to rejoice at all times, how in the world do we do that? Well, we do it like Habakkuk. We picture God's renewing mercy, we picture God's glorious majesty, and we picture God's saving might. And I think Paul knew about that when he wrote Philippians 4. Because actually, Paul went through a lot of stuff. He went through a lot of stuff. Almost stoned to death. Whipped, beaten, possibly thrown to lions. And this is actually what all of this passage says. Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. Let your gentle spirit be known to all men. The Lord is near. Be anxious for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all comprehension, will guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. Does that sound like a backup to you? That's to me. Next few moments, I'm going to pray and give you a chance to respond. And I will challenge you, no matter who you are in the room, to picture God as this passage describes. And as you picture God, respond as God is telling you, maybe that you want to just pray to Him about the view and just rejoice in the moment. Maybe you're challenged to make a decision, whether it's to repent of a sin or to join His church or to turn to Him. Or maybe as you picture God's view, you realize that you haven't placed your faith in Jesus Christ and you're not of those that are coming behind Him whose clothes would have been white. And you need to place your faith in Jesus Christ who died on the cross to save. I won't be up here if you want to speak to me. You do as God has laid on your heart.